Psalm 62. We got down through verse 9, 8 or 9 last time. Let's go back to kind of get a handle on the context. Verse 5, let's start there. My soul, wait thou only upon God, for my expectation is from him. We talked about that expectation being a hope, your Christian hope. Last time, he only, verse 6, is my rock and my salvation. He is my defense. I shall not be moved. And so we talked for a while about that. And God is my salvation and my glory. The rock of my strength and my refuge is in God. So you have refuge twice here, verse 7 and verse 8. Verse 8, trust in him at all times. Ye people, pour out your heart before him. God is a refuge for us, Selah. And then we finish with, surely men of low degree are vanity, and men of high degree are a lie. So whether you're low or high, you still ain't much. Amen. Verse 9, again, God is a refuge for us. At the end of verse 9, to be laid in the balance, they are altogether lighter than vanity. They're altogether lighter than vanity. All right, so verse 10, trust not in oppression, become not vain in robbery. If riches increase, set not your heart upon them. Okay, trust not in oppression. You were just told back in verse 8 to trust in God at all times, and we talked about what all times involved. So in verse 10, trust not in oppression. And so the idea there is that, you know, it's easy when you're sitting and you're waiting on God to do something. If you can force it, even if it means forcing it upon somebody, it's much easier and much more natural for you to go ahead and do that than to wait on God to do something. But it says there, trust not in oppression. Yeah, that becomes a habit. I think that some of the bullishness that we see in public life these days, and the way, you know, people talk, and you know, the bombast in newspapers and media and stuff and politicians, I think a lot of that is just the habit of, you know, trying to be forceful and jamming it through. But he says, trust not in oppression. There are some things in the Bible, I'm not going to take you through all of them, to trust not in. First of all, trust not in oppression, but also David said, I trust not in my bow or my sword. David was pretty handy with a bow and a sword and a sling and all kinds of things. He was not a guy you'd want to tangle with in an alley with just weapons laying around. And he says, trust not in your bow or your sword. So, you know, whatever it is that you're good at, whatever it is that you have a hand for, you got to be careful about trusting those things. Whatever you're strong in, whatever you're talented in, whatever you've always had success in, what's always worked for you, you have to be careful not to trust that, because your trust is supposed to be trusting God. Another verse, and again, we could go back through and run through all these verse by verse, but we're called not to trust in princes or in the Son of Man being just a man, not, of course, the Son of God, Jesus Christ. But trust not in princes or the Son of Man. And the idea is man's going to let you down, so trusting him is not going to work for long. You're called to trust in God. Trust not in your own understanding, it says in a couple places, and you know the verse in another place. Trust in the Lord with all thine heart, lean not unto thine own understanding. That is essentially telling you not to trust your own understanding, because you don't understand things right. And the Lord's ways are higher than our ways. His thoughts are higher than our thoughts. Certainly true that his understanding is higher than ours. And so you can't trust yours. Not really. Trust not, it says in another place, in horses or in chariots. So again, military armaments and the numbers of votes and the popularity polls and whatever is popular, those sort of things you need to avoid, trusting those things. Majority opinion doesn't mean the majority is right. And so you've got to be careful of those things. Don't trust in lying words, it says in yet another place. Over and over again, Jeremiah takes the children of Israel to task for believing the lies of the false prophets. And there are certainly many of those around. And nowadays, as usual, many of them intermingle truth with lies. That's part of the trickery, right? If everybody just lied entirely all the time, then there would be no credibility. But, you know, they tell you the truth for a little while and then slip you a Mickey, as they say. So trust not in lying words. But some people do. Some people grow to trust just one particular sector, one particular segment. And very seldom is a particular segment or sector of a group of sinners right all the time. And lastly, just the Bible says, trust not in uncertain riches. We'll say more about riches in just a second. Go back down to verse 10, Psalm 63:10. Trust not in oppression, and become not vain in robbery. If riches increase, set not your heart upon them. Okay? If riches increase, it tells you to set not your heart upon them. Now, I'll go ahead and say why you should not set your heart on riches. We'll deal with that first, but the Bible talks quite a bit about secondarily where you set your heart. But set you not your heart on riches. Look in Proverbs chapter 11 real quick. Proverbs 11. Now, you've heard these riches verses a lot, and I'm only going to run through two or three of them. But when you just need to stop and consider that as an American, you have more or less wallowed in riches for your entire lives. I don't mean that you may have $100,000 in the bank or anything like that, but you've always enjoyed more food than you need and more clothes than you can wear. And you always knew, I mean, I know how things are moving and shifting now, but you know full well that if you need medical care, you can walk into an ER and get help. Okay? You realize that's not the issue in most places in this world. And so you have to be careful about learning to trust in riches. Of course, the high and mighty, they grow to think that because of they have the money, that therefore that settles everything. And plainly, it doesn't. Proverbs chapter 11, go down to verse 28, and notice, he that trusteth in his riches shall fall, but the righteous shall flourish as a branch. There's something more precious than money, and it's righteousness. It's being righteous. In fact, it's being right. And that can be right in the sense, a broader moral sense. It can also be right as far as just being right about a particular issue. But it says there that if you trust in your own riches, you're going to fall. Now go back to chapter 8, verse 18 real fast. I'm just going to hit just two or three of these. And notice this gives you another hint, another conclusion about where the real riches might lie. Verse 11 of chapter 8, for wisdom is better than rubies, and all things that may be desired are not to be compared to it. That's quite a statement. Again, for Americans who are perfectly capable of desiring a lot, right? Everybody has a wish list. And you go on down through that passage, and then in verse 14, counsel is mine, sound wisdom, I am understanding. I have strength, by me kings reign and princes decree justice. By me princes rule and nobles, even all the judges of the earth. I love them that love me, and those that seek me early shall find me. Riches and honor are with me. And that's not always talking about dollars and cents, right? But riches and honor. What kind of price are you going to put on honor? You think about what, you know, some men have done. I suppose that if you really believe that all you get in this life is what you get in this life, then I suppose I could understand how some noteworthy public figures these days would just aspire to an office at all costs, because after all, I mean, you got to leave your mark in this life. Of course, what's really not real to any of them is what goes on in the next life, and the fact that at the judgment, it's complete dishonor. You imagine living eternity in hell, of course, for somebody lost, but the complete unabashed shame, humiliation, and dishonor of what you did. And so you watch, and of course we're not giggling about it or laughing, but you watch a public figure fall, like the governor of New York did this last week and stuff, and you know, it's plainly a dishonor. And it is a dishonor. You know, the Bill Clintons of the world, and we could just keep on naming names, right? But those guys thought that power and money solve things. And it doesn't. It doesn't. Now, go back to Proverbs 23. Let me just finish with a couple of flourishes here on riches. Proverbs 23, it never hurts us. And all of us, of course, don't have a bunch of money in our pocket. But like I said, we're pretty rich by any standards in this world. Proverbs 23, and go on down to verse 4. Proverbs 23, 4, labor not to be rich. Pretty straightforward, huh? So you're in trouble where you will be rich. They say that it will be rich. In other words, they want to. That's what they're striving for. Fall into temptation and condemnation, right? And many foolish and hurtful lusts which drown men in destruction and perdition. You've got to be careful about longing to make that million. You know, look, if you do, praise the Lord. I mean, all that's good, but boy, the desire to be rich is a trap. And it says, labor not to be rich, cease from thine own wisdom, combining those two things. So you should seek for the wisdom of God where the true riches are, like we just read. Wilt thou set thine eyes upon that which is not? Suggesting that riches really are one of those things that are not. I mean, how would you describe them? You look at our stock market, you know what that's all built on? It's all built on confidence. On, you know, men's confidence in the markets, and that tomorrow, if they leave their money in, this stock will sell for more and be worth more than it is today. And if that confidence falls, they start selling it off cheap, and the stock market crashes, and so on and so forth. But stop and consider that we don't have any longer, you know, our system is no longer built on anything of any value, in the sense that we don't live on a gold standard anymore or a silver standard. In effect, much of what is printed is just monopoly money. It really is. I mean, it really, really is. And all that keeps it floating is what confidence men have in it. And so men go to, you know, to the New York Stock Exchange, and they buy into things because they have confidence still that tomorrow this stock will be worth more than it is today or a year from now or whatever. And if the confidence fails, it all comes tumbling down. And so it's illusionary. It's elusive. And I'm not a money guy at all. I understand far less than that about than most people or even my own sons. But I just know that it's built on confidence, and confidence can be a pretty elusive thing. And so when it says, wilt thou set thine eyes upon that which is not, I mean, you don't have $100,000 in your pocket. If you have $100,000 total in the bank, you don't have $100,000 in your pocket. In fact, if you tried to go and draw it all out, you probably couldn't. You know why? Because it's digits. It's digital. It's electrons. It's a number somebody has written in their bank ledgers, bank computer ledgers, however that works these days. Say, what's the point? I'm talking about things I don't know nothing about, okay? I'm just saying, I know it's illusionary. And I know that if you put your trust there, you know, it's your riches fly away like a bird. It's more illusionary than a bird. It doesn't even fly away. It's like it just never was there. Verse 5, wilt thou set thine eyes upon that which is not? For riches certainly make themselves wings. They fly away as an eagle toward heaven. Look at one more here before we shift to something else. Look in Proverbs 27 and 24. And there's only about 300 other verses we could go to, but verse 24, for riches are not forever. Let's start with verse 23. Be thou diligent to know the state of thy flocks and look well to thy herds, for riches are not forever. and doth the crown endure to every generation. The hay appeareth, and the tender grass showeth itself, and herbs of the mountains are gathered. So it indicates, verse 25, there's a seasonal issue to it. Verse 24, that riches are not forever. They kind of come and they kind of go. Isn't that the way your pocketbook is? Or is it all just go? For a lot of folks, I guess it's all just go. But it does. It comes and goes. And there's a couple months out of the year, you feel pretty good about things and you don't worry about it. And then you hit rock bottom again. You know? Did you know that that's life? Did you know the American dream is not Christian as such? I mean, what does the book say? It says, having food and raiment, let us be there with content. You ought to be ashamed of yourself. If you're not content, you know what a sorry rascal you are? Because you have way more than food and raiment, right? And so all those verses, and you start looking at those things, folks, riches don't matter. Not really. Okay, we're back to Psalm 62 and verse 10. And again, to stay on it just a little bit here, it says in the middle of the verse, if riches increase, set not your heart upon them. I want to give you some things that the Lord where the Lord deals with somebody setting their heart somewhere. And there ought to be something that's plain, ought to be something evident. Look in Deuteronomy chapter 32 real quick. For us Bible believers, this ought to be the first thing. And it's hard to get through to somebody who is otherwise minded. But Deuteronomy chapter 32, go all the way down to verse 46. Deuteronomy 32, and we can start reading with verse 44. And Moses came and spake all the words of this song in the ears of the people, he and Hoshea the son of Nun. And Moses made an end of speaking all these words to all Israel, and he said unto them, set your hearts. Okay, that's what we're talking about. Set your heart. Set your hearts unto all the words which I testify among you this day, which ye shall command your children to observe to do, all the words of this law. So if there's something that's true, we always get yelled at as King James Bible believers for putting an overemphasis on the Bible and the Bible's your God and all, you know, idolaters and all that kind of stuff. No, that's not it at all. The issue with the King James Bible is that we're the only group in the world that believe that we have a final authority in our laps. I just want you to know, if you go down the street either way or east or west to any other church in this area, none of them believe that the Bible they hold in their laps are the final authority. They don't. So I tell you what you need to do. You as a Bible believer need to be even more fanatical. You need to set your heart on the words of the living God that you have. That's a place to set your heart. I'll give you some more advice. Look in Ecclesiastes chapter 8. This tracks with several thoughts. Ecclesiastes chapter 8. Where a man or a woman should set their heart or not. Ecclesiastes chapter 8. Maybe you can quote this verse, where it says, because sentence against an evil work is not executed speedily, therefore the heart of the sons of men is fully set in them to do evil. Now what that verse says in different words is that you are as crooked as a dog's hind leg. And because you do something today and you don't get a 2x4 upside the head by tonight, you go, I could probably do that again tomorrow and still not get a 2x4 across the head. And because of that thing, there are folks, that's what leads to all the argumentation about why God doesn't come down hard on the wicked. Why do some people live wickedly for 30 and 40 years, for as long as I've known them, and they just never seem to have any problems, and they have girls, and they have money, and they have cars, and they have, and they have, and they have. And why doesn't God come down on these wicked people? He's setting them up, brethren, I'm telling you right now, because their hearts are fully set in them to do evil. You now live in a country where a bunch of people have as a ruling class moved forward where they think they can do anything they want to do. And God is mad enough at the country to let it go for a while. It just won't go forever. And what he's doing is he's setting them up, because their hearts are now fully set in them to do evil. They don't care if it's constitutional. They don't care if they lied. And if everybody knows they lied, they don't care. I mean, they're hard-nosed set to do evil. And look, you can get that way. You've got to be careful about not going there, because it works the same for you, because you can get away with stuff for quite a while. And Lord doesn't just pound you into the dirt. So got to be careful about that. So let me show you something else then. Look in Psalm 78. No, I'm sorry. 1 Chronicles 22. 1 Chronicles 22. First Chronicles 22:19. Now, we saw that you need to set your heart on the words of the Lord. Okay, here's something else. 1 Chronicles 22:19. Well, let's start with verse 18. Is not the Lord your God with you? And hath he not given you rest on every side? For he hath given the inhabitants of the land unto thine hand, and the land is subdued before the Lord and before his people. Now set your heart and your soul to seek the Lord your God. It's your responsibility. I mean, it's your responsibility to seek the Lord while he may be found. But it's the Lord that you need to seek. In your sickness, in your health, in your poverty, in your riches, it's God you need to seek. It's true. Now look in Psalm 78. Psalm 78. Just some places to set your heart or not. Psalm 78, and go down to verse 6. That the generation to come might know them, talking about what the fathers knew and the testimonies, even the children which should be born, who should arise and declare them to their children, that they might set their hope in God. We've already talked about that. And not forget the works of God, but keep his commandments, and might not be as their fathers, a stubborn and rebellious generation, a generation that set not their heart aright, and whose spirit was not steadfast with God. The earlier generation of the fathers of Israel, they did not set their heart aright. Well, folks, so one of the things that the younger generation needs to learn from the older generation is that where the older generation didn't do right, you need to do right. You know, you can learn all kinds of bad lessons, all kinds of good lessons. There's all kinds of levels. But in the end, whatever mistakes, you know, your fathers made, then you saw them make it. Okay, do it right. Do it better. But the key is do it right. But they set not their hearts aright. The issue is right and wrong. The issue is not expediency versus not so expedient. The issue is not what gets me more or gets me less. The issue is it right? It's always been, is it right? Always has. Right? Okay. Feel kind of quiet. All right. One more here. Actually, that's a lie. More than one. Ezekiel chapter 14. Ezekiel 14. But you can set your heart in the right place. You can set your heart in the wrong place. Ezekiel chapter 14. Verse 1, a great chapter indicating what the Lord might do if you don't come to him in sincerity and with the right heart. But it says in verse 1, then came certain of the elders of Israel unto me and sat before me. And the word of the Lord came unto me, saying, Son of man, these men have set up their idols in their heart, and put the stumbling block of their iniquity before their face? Should I be inquired of at all by them?" And so this goes on to say that these guys are going to come and try to send a prophet to talk to God. And because of the idols they have set up in their heart, the Lord is going to give the prophet wrong information to take back to him to deceive him. See, you got to inquire after God for the truth instead of just wanting him to say and check off what you want to do. You have to go to God and say, "Lord, I want the truth." All right, there's a couple other things here. Look in Daniel chapter 10. Daniel 10. Where to set your heart or not. Daniel chapter 10. This is that place where Daniel is finally sent help. And in verse 10, "And behold, an hand touched me, which set me upon my knees and upon the palms of my hands. And he said unto me, O Daniel, a man greatly beloved, understand the words that I speak unto thee, and stand upright." So get up off your hands and knees. "For unto thee am I now sent, and when he had spoken this word unto me, I stood trembling. Then said he unto me, Fear not, Daniel, for from the first day that thou didst set thine heart to understand." Okay, you ought to set your heart to understand. And all the answers don't come all at once, but you say, understand what? Understand all manner of things. Whatever it is that has always been a quest for you in life, a question that hasn't been answered, set your heart to understand. And if it has to do with why God allows some things or why God does some things a certain way, set your heart to understand. The answers are in the book. They really are. But you ought to set your heart to understand. Because some people don't want to understand. Not really. Right? Okay, just one more here and then we'll do something else. All right? Look in Hosea. Hosea chapter 4. Hosea chapter 4. In verse 6 it says this: "My people are destroyed for lack of knowledge. Because thou hast rejected knowledge, I also will reject thee. That thou shalt be no priest unto me, seeing thou hast forgotten me, the law of thy God, also I will forget thy children. As they were increased, so they sinned against me. Therefore will I change their glory into shame. They eat up the sin of my people, and they set their heart on their iniquity." And you're now living in a generation that sets their hearts on their iniquity. They like it. And sin has never been that unpleasant. Right? But boy, I mean, if there are lovers of sin, now is the day. But they set their heart on their iniquity, and that is not your calling. Okay, back to Psalm 62. Any questions or comments so far? All right, Psalm 62, and notice down in verse 10. "Trust not in oppression, and become not vain in robbery. If riches increase, set not your heart upon them." Don't go for them. "God hath spoken once, twice have I heard this, that power belongeth unto God. Also unto thee, O Lord, belongeth mercy, for thou renderest to every man according to his work." Now, we discussed this some in the chapter before this, but you'll notice in verse 11, power is connected with mercy in verse 12. If you'll go back to 61:7, "He shall abide before God forever. O prepare mercy and truth, which may preserve him." And the idea there that was kind of put across is the idea that those two things go together. I mean, you better thank God that God is merciful. I mean, we like the truth. We do. Sanctify them through thy truth. Thy word is truth. We like the truth. We like the Bible. But boy, if it was just all unmitigated truth, we would all be grease spots. We'd all be little cinders because, I mean, just the truth, we just get eaten up because we're sinners. So thank God for mercy. You have need for mercy because you have the truth. And by the same token, if you'll go down to verse, back to where we were in Psalm 63, in verse 11, the same thing goes with power. I mean, when you have a God who has the power and the omniscience, the knowledge, and he is a God of truth, and, you know, there is no mitigating or softening elements, that God is rough. So you ought to thank God that God is a God of mercy. You ought to thank the Lord that he's a God of long-suffering and tenderness. Because without that, just raw power, just raw holiness, just raw truth, you know, the skin on our faces would all be peeled back. We'd all be dead. We'd all be cinders. But God loveth to have mercy. And so praise the Lord for that. Amen. So verse 12, also unto thee, O Lord, belongeth mercy, for thou renderest to every man according to his work. Now in 63:1, we can pick something else back up. It says, O God, thou art my God. Okay, he was somebody else's God before he was David's God, and he's somebody else's God before he was yours. But you need to make the claim. He's your God. It's not just because your mom and daddy went to this church and you were born and reared here and all this kind of stuff and all the close, intimate, you know, spiritual friends you have here and that kind of thing. But it ought to be because God is your God. It says, O God, thou art my God. And then it says, early will I seek thee. And so there's lots of preaching that can go into that. Early is when you need to seek God. And failing early, then as early as possible after that, get it back on it. I wish I'd sought God early when I got saved. I got saved at 10. I wish I'd sought him earlier than I did. As it was, I got back on the boat as quickly as I had sense enough to do, so I got back on at 20 years old and started trying to serve him. But the earlier you start, the better. Okay, there will be some naivete. There will be some things that you wrestle with. Look, the nature of sinners in this life is you're going to wrestle with something. You're either going to be a wretched sinner who now has memories of all you did before you got saved, and so all those things are going to plague you for a long time. Something will. Or else you may be, you know, somebody got saved at 4 or 5 and never drank anything, you know, stronger than buttermilk, and, you know, were always a good kid and all those things. And in that respect, you're going to have your own struggles. But it's not an issue of one is better than the other. It's the nature of the Christian life is struggle. To apprehend God, to seek God, and the best thing you can do is to seek God sincerely and to seek God early. Early in life, early in the day, as early after a mistake as possible. It says, seek God early. O God, thou art my God. Early will I seek thee. My soul thirsteth for thee. There's genuine spirituality. There's somebody who longs for God in the inward parts. And, you know, it's not about outward things, but, you know, my soul thirsteth for thee. I wish I was more like that. I mean, I wish we all were more like that. We are so besieged by fleshy things and by material things. I just wish, you know, just once in a while you meet somebody who just seems, and maybe it's all a facade, but that just seems genuinely spiritual and doesn't really care about other stuff out there. And so that's good, but that's that spirit. That's the soul. My soul thirsteth for thee. My flesh also, though, David says, longeth for thee in a dry land and thirsty land, a dry and thirsty land where no water is. Well, if you're crawling around through the desert and you haven't had a drink of water for 2 days, you're going to be seeking God, right? Because you need some water. Well, what happens today is that the churches are appealing to flesh, and so that folks want God because of their flesh. They want their flesh satisfied. So now, you know, if you're disenchanted or don't feel appreciated, or if you not if you you know, have suffered intolerance, then come to Jesus, because he can heal you. Right? Well, that's out here. That's flesh. That's material. So we all know that we're more spiritual when we're sick. That, boy, when it comes to funeral homes and hospitals, we will pray fervently then. Well, you're being forced into that because of the flesh. So you need more soul. But nowadays, it's like the whole thing, if you're not careful, is geared toward, you know, trying to make my little pink flesh feel better. Because after all, I don't feel appreciated, but Jesus appreciates me. You know, I just had such low self-esteem, but now I have my self-esteem back because Jesus gave it to me. It's not only silly, it's flesh. Now, and that can lead you to the right place, and all of us seek God at times because our flesh is discomfited. In fact, that is why sometimes the Lord discomfits our flesh. It's because if you had everything in the flesh that you needed, you'd be a living devil. You'd be so sorry. You wouldn't be worth shooting. And now it costs more to kill a guy because bullets are more. But you wouldn't be worth shooting if you got all you wanted in the flesh. And so God afflicts your flesh, and he makes you hurt, and he makes you sick, and he lets you have this problem, and he lets you have that problem, so that you get back. I mean, so that you get back to the Lord, and he gives you another chance at the soul thirsting for thee, not just the flesh, not just the flesh. And so you come through a little revival where the Lord maybe resolves some of your physical ills, and you appreciate him so much, and your gratitude soars, and your hopes and your joys are, you know, back up on the mountain peak for a little while, but they all tend to always lose altitude because so often it's the flesh that dictates so much. But we all need a little more soul. And I'm not talking about some weird 70s comedy either. Okay, 63:1, O God, thou art my God, early will I seek thee. My soul thirsteth for thee. My flesh longeth for thee in a dry and thirsty land where there is no water. To see thy power and thy glory, so have I have seen thee in the sanctuary. To see thy power and thy glory, so as I have seen thee in the sanctuary. Okay, 77:13, Psalms. Psalm 77:13. Thy way, O God, is in the sanctuary. Who is so great a God as our God? Okay. Now, I hadn't done this before, but I tracked it down, and oddly enough, this study on sanctuary is kind of interesting. I think we can go through it real quick here. I'm just going to name you 8 different things or places where the Lord's sanctuary is. And as it turns out, there are 8 of them. Kind of ironic, probably. But first of all, let me see where I want to start. First of all, Exodus chapter 15. Exodus chapter 15. It's good to go through the Bible and have the Bible define the limits of a word sometimes, because otherwise your imagination runs off with you and you are thinking wacky thoughts. Exodus chapter 15, go down to verse 17. 15:17. Clearly defined. Talking about going into the land. Thou shalt bring them in and plant them in the mountain of thine inheritance, in the place, O Lord, which thou hast made for thee to dwell in the sanctuary, O Lord, which thy hands have established. That's That's Israel, as Israel's sanctuary. And it's a capital S there in verse 17, but that's the Lord bringing Israel into their land. It's essentially Canaan, right? Okay, then there's Psalm 102. Look at Psalm 102, verse 19. Psalm 102 and verse 19. Okay, for he, God, hath looked down from the height of his sanctuary. From heaven did the Lord behold the earth. So the Lord has a sanctuary in heaven. That's no big secret, probably. One sanctuary is here on this earth, Israel, which everybody's trying to divide up and cut up like a piece of carrion, right? That's a Lord's land. That's the Lord's sanctuary. So it ain't going to work out too well for him. Look in Exodus 25 now. Exodus 25. You could probably guess this one. Exodus 25. Now this is plainly the sanctuary of the tabernacle, okay? And he let them... And let them make me a sanctuary that I may dwell among them. This is about, you know, of course, middle of Exodus. That's the Lord setting up the standards for the sanctuary in the tabernacle. So heaven, Israel itself, Canaan land, and the tabernacle. Look in 1 Chronicles 22, so therefore this wouldn't come as a surprise. 1 Chronicles 22. And verse 19, now set your heart and your soul to seek the Lord your God. We were just here, weren't we? Arise therefore and build ye the sanctuary of the Lord God. Okay, that's talking about Solomon's temple. So there was a sanctuary in Solomon's temple, just like there was a sanctuary on the earthly tabernacle, just like Israel is considered a sanctuary, just like heaven is a sanctuary. And then with that, there's also... And I'll just let you write this one down. Look in Nehemiah 10:39. You don't have to go there. It's talking about the sanctuary. That sanctuary is the temple that was built in Nehemiah and Ezra's day. And so with that, you wouldn't be surprised. Probably for Daniel chapter 8. One more time. Daniel chapter 8. And verse 11, talking about the Antichrist at this point. Yea, he magnified himself even to the prince of the host, and by him the daily sacrifice was taken away, and the place of his sanctuary was cast down. There's going to be another sanctuary when the temple is built in the tribulation. So you have a tabernacle in the wilderness. You have Solomon's sanctuary. You have Nehemiah, Ezra's sanctuary. You have one in the great tribulation. And then finally look in Ezekiel chapter 37. Ezekiel 37. This is the millennial sanctuary. Ezekiel 37, verse 28. 37 28, and the heathen shall know that I, the Lord, do sanctify Israel when my sanctuary shall be in the midst of them forevermore. It's talking about the millennial sanctuary. Now, beyond that, there's just one more I'd have you see. Look in Isaiah chapter 8. Y'all were there on Sunday morning. Isaiah chapter 8. You have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 sanctuaries that revolve around the temple, or rather the tabernacle in the wilderness through the millennial temple. There are 6 sanctuaries. Because why 6? Because that's where man worships, right? Then you have the sanctuary that's in heaven from Psalm 102, and then there's this, and this is what you and I have. If you never show up to the earthly sanctuary, it won't matter. I think you will. I think you'll go. But it won't matter. Because in Isaiah chapter 8, down in verse 14, and he shall be for a sanctuary. Who? Sanctify the Lord of hosts himself, verse 13. Let him be your fear, let him be your dread. He shall be for a sanctuary, but for a stone of stumbling and for a rock of offense to both the houses of Israel. So the stone of stumbling, the rock of offense, was rejected by them but received by me, and I was put in him. He's my sanctuary. So that's kind of cool. Six earthly sanctuaries for man, and God speaking from his sanctuary in heaven, and then we have our own. It's kind of cool. All right, questions or comments? All right, let's